Welcome to the second session of our webinar today. We have gone through our first session providing a general overview for the economy and the farm program. I'd like to thank our first speakers. This is our Ag in Uncertain Times series of webinars. This is the continuing series. The team here is from Montana, Colorado, Arizona, the University of California, Davis, Wyoming, and Washington State, and the Western Center. I'd like to take a minute to thank all of those teams. They're working in the backgrounds to help us out. I will be your MC for this session. I'm Dwayne Griffith. I'm in Extension Farm Management from Montana State University. This is a continuing series. Our theme for this series is the fast pace of change. And this session will cover outlook for crops, corn and soybeans and wheat, and for forage outlook also for the livestock folks and other interested participants. We're going to review the current conditions that have some significant positive or negative impacts on market conditions. The speakers, Ed Usset is a grain marketing specialist at the University of Minnesota. For the Center for Farm Financial Management. He works with those folks also very closely. Randy Fortenberry, professor and endowed chair at the School of Economics of Science at Washington State University, and Dr. Shannon Nybergs, Extension Economics at Washington State University, and also recently took over the directorship of the Western Center for Risk Management Education. We thank all of those for helping us out today and deliver this particular session. Before we get started, a note, you can interact with the speakers at any time. Simply click on the box in the lower portion of the Q&A pod on the left-hand side of the screen. You can type a question, and when you get done typing that question, it will be sent to us that are working with the information in the background. That question will be answered after each speaker has a chance to present their material, and we'll get to those as we cycle through the speakers and at the end of the session. We would like to point you also to our companion Ag in Uncertain Times webpage. There you can visit the past speakers, their presentations, contact information, and the recorded sessions are all available for viewing at any point in time, and we'll get that again here toward the end of the session here. If you have difficulty seeing any of the images or slides on the screen, you can always expand the view of those. In the upper right-hand portion of the screen on the slide set, there is a full screen button. You can toggle that on and off. The full screen uses your entire screen real estate, and if you toggle it back off, then you get to see the image and the Q&A on the left. And that's you can toggle it on and off to access the Q&A pod at any point in time. We'll start off here with a few questions. We'd like to know a little bit of information about where you are and your particular background. The question here is the type of background you have: an agricultural producer, extension educator, banking professional, agribusiness professional, commodity organization employee, and have a little bit of time to answer those. And we're loading this. The next question here, a little bit about where you are from: Northeast U.S., Southeast, Midwest, Southwest, West Pacific Islands, or if you happen to be an international visitor today. A little bit of time to click on the appropriate button there and help us out. And the last introductory question here is the trying to get some information about the number of people that are at the site that you have. If you're joining us alone, or if you're joining us with a group of one or more people. And I think that will be all for our introductory slides. At this point, we'll transition into our first speaker here. That's Dr. Ed Ussett. He's a grain marketing specialist for the University of Minnesota. He also works closely with the Center for Farm Financial Management, which is located there also. And he has teaches futures and options marketing at the university. He has some award-winning Winning the Game and Tool Time, a series of workshops that is used pretty much nationwide in terms of teaching marketing skills, the interaction, the mechanics, and allowing some hands-on practice for marketing commodities in the U.S. And Ed has also published a book, his first book, Grain Marketing is Simple, It's Just Not Easy. How true that is. And with that, Ed, I think you're set up and ready to go here. We'll turn it over to you, and you can take it away.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, or good afternoon to those of you in the Eastern time zone. But good morning for the most of us. My name is Ed Ussett. I'm a grain marketing specialist with the Center for Farm Financial Management at the University of Minnesota. One modest correction, I've been referred to as Dr. Ed Ussett, and I do not have a PhD degree. I'm not a doctor. I tell people I play one as I travel around, but I'm not really a doctor. I have a master's degree and quite pleased with that. My job this morning is to talk about something I don't normally talk about, and that is outlook, corn and soybean outlook. A brief look at some numbers at play, and what we're looking at. And I may even venture into territory no one should go, and that is with a bold price projection here as we look ahead this spring. I'm going to look first at corn. I'm going to show you a balance sheet, and it's maybe a dull format, but it gives me a chance to focus on some key numbers in the balance sheet, supply and demand. So we'll get started, and what I'm showing here is the balance sheet for corn, highlighted in the middle in green, is the balance sheet for the current crop year. The crop year in corn, of course, is September 1 through August 31. And we're a little over the halfway point in that crop year, just at the halfway point. And progressing through, and I'm going to talk about some of the numbers you see there. On the far right of this balance sheet is the preliminary projections put out by the USDA in their 2012 Ag Outlook Forum that took place in late February. They do this every year. Or they have been doing it for about a decade. They put out, if you will, the USDA does their peek into the year ahead. Now, this is 2012-2013. Again, this applies to the year starting September 1, 2012, and through next year. It's preliminary. I don't think they'll call it official. Their first official look at 2012-13 will come with the May WASDE report, but I want to look at some of these numbers. First, thinking about the current year we're in, I'm crossing out the upper half, the supply side. That's kind of known. I don't think we have many secrets there left. We've made our good estimates, projections on planted acres and harvested acres and yields and so on. We know what we've produced. What's left is some question about the demand side, and I'll just point at some interesting numbers. One I'll point at is the feed and residual numbers for the current crop year, and compare them, if you will, to corn for ethanol. I just want to make a point here. We're using today more corn in the production of ethanol than we are feeding to cows and pigs and chickens. And that's a remarkable thing. Now, this is not the first year. I believe last year was the first year that happened. But it points to a change in leadership in the corn market. And I think everyone listening understands this. And yet, I don't know if we can overemphasize it enough. The corn market is being led by different forces today than it was just 10 years ago, 20 years ago. If you ask me to project the price of corn, to give you thoughts on the price of corn going out 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, today, if you ask me that today, I'm going to ask you, well, what do you think the price of oil will do? Because when we start turning corn into ethanol, or when we're doing it to the degree we are, that's the main driver here. I'm not diminishing the feed side. It's almost an equal partner. But this energy side is a big, big player. And so you ask me, where's corn going? I'll ask you, where's oil going? This is a chart just showing the remarkable growth in corn used in ethanol production over the last three decades. And what is noteworthy here is sort of that hockey stick shape to this bar chart, and yet it is leveling off in the last couple of years. I can't talk about the current year, can't talk about the corn market without at least mentioning ethanol. Now, I'm going to point you to a number at the bottom of the supply and demand here, and that's ending stocks. Ending stocks of corn are projected at about 800 million bushels this year. That sure sounds like a lot if you think of landing in your living room or something like that, but that's not where it is. And given our base of consumption, that's a very narrow level of ending stocks, and I'll show you how narrow that ending stocks level is. This is a simple chart of the last six decades of U.S. ending stocks to use. I'm measuring it. I'm measuring ending stocks. This is stocks of corn in the U.S. as of August 31st, the end of the crop year. And it is shown in weeks of carryover. It's not shown chronologically. It's shown from, if you will, highest to lowest. And you can see that we've had years, many years ago, where we would have a half a year's worth of supply, 25 to 30 weeks worth of supply on hand as the new crop was beginning to be harvested. Well, we don't live in those times anymore. You can see us way on the far right. The red line indicates where we are this year. We've got something on the order of 3 to 3.5 weeks of corn usage on hand when the crop year ends. That's the projection. That's very tight. I used to be a buyer for a flour mill, and I'm just putting myself today in the shoes of someone feeding cattle, someone buying corn for an ethanol plant. That's a very skinny, skinny margin. It's a tight carryout, can't be overemphasized. You can't run a business with 2 days worth of corn on hand. You need a couple weeks for most of us. So this is a very, very tight carryout and worthy of note, and probably the biggest single driving force as we look at the current crop year. Now I want to shift gears, though, because we're halfway through the current crop year. We've got a March planting intentions report coming out at the end of this month, and it will point ahead to next year, 2012-13. And I'd like to just peek at a few numbers there, if I may. For example, USDA is indicating planted acres in the year ahead, 94 million acres of corn. That's 2 million acres more than a year ago. I follow the chatter in the industry. I think a lot of people feel with favorable planting conditions that we have that that number could, in fact, be 95 million acres. We're going to find out soon enough. But I'm not uncomfortable with the USDA's look there as they look to the year ahead. But it could be a little bit bigger. We are going to have, it appears to me, as I sit in my Swank office in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it's about 60 degrees, we're going to get in the fields early. And the persistent dryness, we're going to get that crop in unless there's a sudden change in weather patterns in the next few weeks. Corn for ethanol decreasing a bit in the year ahead. Noteworthy, a lot of chatter on ethanol. A lot of chatter that these plants aren't making money. They're going to start paring back. Ethanol stocks are large, and yet every week I see the reports come out, and they seem to be hanging in there just fine in terms of production. But it is noteworthy, a modest reduction seen in the year ahead. These are the numbers we should be paying attention to. Again, I emphasize this is from the USDA. They are projecting an average corn yield in the U.S. of 164 bushels the acre. And that is, that strikes me as ambitious. And it is based on that high yield that, that we're going to end up with a big, big production number, almost 2 billion bushels more corn this year than last year. But that 164, it strikes me as large. The bears will point to it, say it's doable. I agree, it's doable. Technology is such, it's doable, but a lot of things got hit right to do that. And I can't help but point you to some discussion going out there. I'm a follower of Dr. Elwin Taylor out of Iowa State University. This was a headline from about a week ago, 10 days ago. Climatologist sees signs of a looming drought, and he points to three things going on. A continuing La Nina, which a La Nina weather event generally spells warmer, drier temperatures in the Corn Belt, at least the northern part of the Corn Belt. So we got that going on. Elwin also notes that South Carolina endured a drought last year. That may seem like an odd thing to refer to. What does it mean that South Carolina, a southeastern state, not even in the Corn Belt, has a drought? Well, Elwin is someone who notes that many of our major droughts start in the southeast and move to the Midwest. And Elwin notes, and I can vouch for this, that a good chunk of the northern tier of Iowa and a good chunk of the southern tier of Minnesota is in the midst of a severe drought. We really lack moisture in some of these areas. So Elwin puts the odds of a drought somewhere at a 50-50 chance. For you bulls out there, I will remind you that 50-50 means that there's a 50% chance of a perfectly normal year going on here, too. But we look at that, and it makes me get a little queasy about the 164 bushel number. And I point you instead now to a balance sheet where I plugged in a different yield number, a different trend line yield. This, by the way, is inside baseball talk for analysts, but what is a trend line yield? USDA says 164. I pulled this 157 from our friends and colleagues at the University of Illinois. Doctors Scott Irwin and Daryl Good do a great job out there, and they would argue that trend line yields are not that high. They're closer to 157 bushels of the acre. And if you flow that through, we don't end up with doubling our ending stocks at the end of the year. We end up with a modest 200 million bushel increase in ending stocks. This is a normal year. Butt-kicking drought-type numbers, nor is it the ambitious 164 average yield indicated by the USDA. I think this is a little more of a realistic look at the year ahead. But back to our current situation, because I think this is what speaks to what I want to talk about prices the rest of the year. It's a very tight carryout, and I've got a table here with probably too much information, but I want you to know that the current year we're in, I think the I think what's ruling this year right now, we look at the tight carryout. We also look at an inverse from old crop to new crop. That is July corn futures, if you look at them, are trading at a significant premium, a 80 to 90 cent premium, to the new crop December contract. So we've got a tight carryout, and we've got an inverse, and you know what? We've got other years like that going back to 1990. And in fact, I found five other similar years, and they're listed there. 93, 94, 95, 96, 96, 97, 2003 and 4, 2010, 11, last year. They all have in common a tight carryout. They all have in common an inverse in the July-December old crop, new crop spread. And on the right, I looked for where did prices go in the spring. And all of the years, except for the first year in question, 93-94, there we saw a peak in January, an early peak in cash prices, and a slow fading off of prices into the spring with another rally in June. But every other year is noted by prices peaking out later in the spring, even into early summer. And that's the territory we're in. And so my guesstimate, if you will, on corn is that I expect corn prices and basis both to hold firm until this market is convinced of better 2012 crop prospects. And, you know, it's mid-January. We haven't planted a thing yet. We got some time to go before we are convinced of better crop prospects. I'm going to shift gears here to soybeans and take much less time on soybeans. I think that corn is king and the main focus. Soybeans, we've got some numbers to look at here, too. I'm already looking ahead to next year. A lot of people thinking that we'll get USDA thinking same number of acres of soybeans this year as last year. Here again, I could be convinced of a modest increase, and there's chatter of that being a million acres higher. Similar issue with the yields. USDA has a pretty healthy yield forecast in there, which would run contrary to what Elwin Taylor's talking about, or a more modest look by our friends at the University of Illinois, but it's there. We're going to keep an eye on that. Export numbers, that's a big one for next year, but of course, South America has had its problems, and we see prospects for good export numbers in the year ahead. Ending stocks, tightening up quite a bit in the year ahead, according to USDA, and I can't disagree with that. I can't disagree with that. If you look at the ending stocks to use, the same format I used in corn, only I have a different measure of ending stocks to use. I'm using a percentage, not weeks of usage, just to mix it up a little bit. You see that our carryout for next year, I've jumped ahead a year here, modest. And makes the price prospects in soybeans a little more interesting. I find it maybe a little puzzling that at least in their early look, USDA has soybean prices steady to maybe even a little bit lower in the year ahead than the year we're currently looking at, which is puzzling given the tightening of stocks, but it speaks to how much credence they're putting on those corn numbers and a big corn crop moderating all prices. Prices have been showing strength in the current crop year for soybeans. A lot of good things going on. Planted acres are a wild card for next year. We'll get a better handle on that by the end of March. But on corn and soybeans, you know, we've got this macro-micro view. The micro view on corn with the tight carryouts is positive. The macro view, this world view of economies and where the world economy is going, is sort of the wet rag on this whole thing. Concerning 2012 crop prospects, maybe we have some listeners here from Missouri, but state motto in Missouri is show me. It's the show me state, and I'm in a show me state of mind when it comes to 2012. We're going to have a hard time breaking prices sharply until you show me that, in fact, this crop is developing the way some optimistic people think it will. I think that's about it for my thoughts on corn and soybeans, and I'm looking forward to Randy's thoughts on wheat.
Okay, thank you, Ed. We'll take just a minute here before we get Randy queued up to ask a question. One of the questions come in from the audience. Although not a perfect substitute for corn, how much does the growth in DDG use add to feed supplies, and how does that follow on and impact corn markets?
Well, it's certainly a big player. Some people have more sophisticated ways of adding that into the balance sheet. USDA hasn't done it yet. When I say more corn is going into ethanol than into feed channels, I know a lot of people want to correct me and say, well, wait a second, 25% of the corn that goes into ethanol, in fact, comes back into feed channels as DDGs. It's true, and it's become a major feed source in the market. And I don't have a nice, slick way of putting that into the balance sheet, though.
Okay. One more quick question, and we'll go on to Randy. How are the high corn prices impacting current and future land prices? We've heard some pretty interesting, maybe anecdotal stories about land prices. Are they going to continue to push land prices up, keep land prices up? What's your thoughts?
Good. It's a very simple equation here. Good corn prices. More important than corn prices, good profitability. Right now, you know, just having high corn prices isn't enough to keep the land prices up. It's the there's a great deal of profitability in the last couple of years in corn and soybean production, and you know, keeping prices high helps that. But, of course, input costs are the other side of the equation. They seem to be catching up some here. So as long as profitability stays high, those land prices are going to stay high.
Okay. We'll go ahead and switch over here to Randy as we get him set up. Randy is going to provide his perspective on outlook for wheat in the U.S. Randy's a professor and endowed chair in grain economics in the School of Economic Sciences at Washington State University. He previously was the Rink, I hope I pronounced that right, Professorship of Agribusiness, and was the director of the Rink Agribusiness Institute in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In addition, Randy was the associate director of the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative. Research activities include price discovery and risk management in agriculture and energy markets, issues related to economics and bioenergy, and issues related to agricultural production and trade. And he serves as the Director of Research for Frontier Risk Management in Chicago, or has served in the past. Randy was at one time a student here at Montana State University and went on to get through the system and got his degree at North Carolina State University and was employed there. Randy, I think you're set up and ready to go. Whoops. Sorry, Randy. degree is at University of Illinois and then went to North Carolina. So I'll let you take that away.
Okay, thanks very much, and good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I want to talk just a few minutes about sort of the wheat market, and I'm kind of calling it a challenging environment. Last year and a half, things have been a little different in the wheat market relative to previous experience, and a lot of it's tied to the same things Ed was talking about in terms of especially the corn market, but the other commodities as well. I have a balance sheet here similar to Ed that's got a little bit more information on it. I just want you to pay attention to three things on here that we're going to come back to as we go forward, and that's really the bottom lines. The ending stocks, 825 million bushels. Now, for wheat, of course, the marketing year ends June 30th, so that's how much we think we'll have left over at the end of June going into the 2011-2012 harvest. The stocks to use, similar to that graph that just showed you for soybeans, is about 38%. And as you look back across previous years, the last couple of years it's been pretty high, but that's a big number relative to the early parts of the 2000s. Associated with that, though, is this very high farm price of about $7.30 a bushel that USDA is projecting. Generally, we would look at those two things and think maybe they don't make sense, that we have relatively high stocks to use, a significant amount of wheat left over relative to consumption, and at the same time, a very high price. But it's partly because we are really connected to the corn market for wheat this last year and a half, and that's part of what's driving this price. But I want you to remember those numbers because I'm going to give you a little bit of caution going forward about whether those are really achievable and what it might mean if they're not. This is just a picture of wheat, corn, and soybean prices over the last decade, and what I want you to notice is wheat had a pretty consistent premium over corn up until early 2010, and then as the wheat price really started to correct from that near $10 mark, this is for all wheat in the cash market, all varieties, we came down and hit the corn price, and then for the last year and a half, we've really traded with corn. As corn moves up, wheat prices move up, corn moves down, wheat prices move down. They've really become integrated. This is important because if you think about the dynamics that Ed described, a relatively tight corn market, even with a good planting season, potential for carryout to remain relatively tight next year, contrast that with a wheat market where worldwide we're going to have probably a record carryout this year, and in the U.S. certainly an increasing carryout over a year ago, relatively large stocks to use. What does that mean for price? I want to talk about two things though related to the price, not just the price level but the volatility. A lot of arguments that biofuels production has driven up commodity prices. We know that's true for corn. We might debate whether it explains $5 corn or $7 corn, but we know that it certainly has resulted in corn prices being significantly higher than they were before 2008. But what about volatility? Volatility generally is driven by uncertainty. And if you go back and look at the monthly balance sheets USDA puts out with the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, you'll see very little change from month to month in expected ethanol use of corn. What does change is exports oftentimes, sometimes the feed demand changes, some of the other demand use categories. So while ethanol might contribute to higher prices, certainly has contributed to higher prices, and that has impacted the wheat market, I don't think it really explains to a large degree the volatility we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. So there's other dynamics in these markets that are affecting both perceptions of risk and then the strategy somebody might use to manage risk going forward. This picture just shows you, again, going back over 30 years now, or 20 years, the convergence of wheat and corn prices as we've moved into the last year and a half. I want to bring this out because, and Ed pointed this out too, this year that we're currently in, about halfway through, as Ed pointed out, and next year are the first 2 years where we expect to see year-over-year decreases in corn consumption for ethanol production. What that does mean is, even if you think ethanol explains the current price level and wheat is linked to the current corn price level, we've probably flattened out at least over the next two crop years in terms of growth in that demand center. Now, as Ed suggested, oil prices will be critical in determining whether we go further along increasing ethanol production and therefore increasing demand for corn, but for the next two marketing years, I think we're really going to see a flattening out. So what that does mean is, whatever the ride was ethanol gave us to higher prices, we probably have sort of reached the end of that. It's become a mature market. So we probably don't want to expect ethanol production to take us to even higher price levels relative to where we are now. Another volatility perception, it's speculative activity in the derivatives that's driving increased volatility in prices. I want to show you, this is kind of a busy graph, but we'll go through it quickly. You'll notice that the sort of the gold line, I call that speculator's net position. What that is, every week, I'm looking at the total long positions of large reportable non-commercial traders minus their short positions. So for hedgers, it's the same thing. Their long position for commercial reportable traders minus their short position, and then we're marking out on the price on the right axis. So there's a lot of busyness here, but if you look from 1999 up through early 2007, where we really saw commodity prices take off, both increased volatility, increased price levels, there doesn't seem to be much correlation between who's long, who's short, and where the price is actually going. But we start to see a lot more correlation between the price of wheat and the net futures positions of these large speculators from 2007 forward. But there's one interesting thing to note. In the we've read a lot, of course, about long index funds, the long funds driving both price levels and volatility. But if you look at wheat, this is from 2007 to 2011, notice that for most of this period, the large speculators in the wheat market were short, not long. Now, the price still seems to track their positions. If you look from July 29th of 2010, when they start to become less short and eventually become net long, the price sort of tracks their market position. But it's not like these large funds have been long wheat through these periods where they were long oil, long soybeans, and oftentimes long corn. They've had different positions in the wheat market. That's important because as we think about potential policy solutions, if you want to call them solutions, to price volatility and or derivative market action, it turns out that one size doesn't fit all. The positions in these markets vary by different commodity across traders. And in fact, this chart shows you total open interest. So this is all the positions in the market at the close of each trading day and just speculator open interest. And you'll notice that as the markets have increased volatility in wheat, the speculators have become a smaller percentage of the market, not a larger percentage. That goes against much of the conventional wisdom we read about, suggesting that the problems in price dynamics stimulates from speculative activity in the market, and them actually taking a larger market share relative to a smaller market share. Again, this graph now from 2007 forward just shows speculator open interest relative to wheat price. And we do see a relationship, though, as the speculators' positions increase, become more net long, the price seems to respond. One more way to look at that, this is the net position, so longs minus shorts again, a little bit of a relationship. The third thing that often is used to explain the current volatility in the market are international events. Some of the macro events that Ed talked about earlier, in other words, things outside of the control of the individual market participants are actually driving volatility. One thing we certainly know, and wheat, this is very important because it's a very important export crop, and in fact, much of the wheat grown here in the northeast part of Washington, probably 75 or 80% of it goes to the export market. As the value of the dollar does decrease, the price responds in a positive way, as we would expect, and this shows us, over the last 6 years, a strong relationship between volatility and price levels in the market and the value of the dollar. So all of those things matter, but what has tended to happen is we focused on those three things, biofuels, speculative activity and derivatives, international events, and we've assumed that the fundamentals don't matter like they once did. And maybe that explains why we can have in the balance sheet a high price expectation even with a very high stocks to use ratio based on historical patterns. One of the things I want to argue is that's really not true, but what has happened is the commodity grain markets especially have become more integrated than they were before, and the dynamics driving one market now influence the other markets to a greater extent than they possibly did. And one way to think about that is pricing wheat as a feed grain. Now, if you go back and look at the balance sheet, we were only expected to feed 145 million bushels of wheat this year, which is less than we have sometimes fed in the past. But because corn is high priced, on the margin, wheat's always being looked at as a potential substitute into the ration. And what that does mean is it doesn't take big changes in the demand on the corn balance sheet for people to start thinking maybe wheat becomes a more viable feed alternative. What this picture shows you from 2004-05 forward is sort of the wheat fed in millions of bushels relative to the wheat price. And if you look at 2011-2012, we're suddenly distancing ourselves from that relationship. In other words, we have this very high $7.20 expected farm price from USDA with feed demand being relatively constant over the last 2 or 3 years. So we're starting to separate. If we really believe the $7.20, we have to believe one of two things. Either corn prices are going to go significantly higher, maybe they will, or wheat is now starting to separate itself from the demand market for feed. I actually don't think that's a reasonable bet. Here's the prices from 2006 forward, corn versus all wheat, and you'll see that through last week, we're still tracking right on top of the corn price. Now, we have started to see some separations by variety. For example, white wheat in Northeast Washington has gone from about a 50 to 60 cent negative basis, cash price 60 to cents below soft red winter wheat in Chicago, to about a 50 cent positive basis. So the basis itself has moved by a dollar or so, but overall, soft red winter wheat prices on the board still are tracking very closely to corn prices. If you think about that, and remember, Ed had a bit of a positive picture on the balance sheet looking forward, part of it based on production, smaller expected yield than USDA suggested last month. But here's a couple of things to think about from the feed demand side. Cattle numbers are at their lowest level in 60 years, according to the cattle on feed report we got a couple of months ago. Dairy margins tend to be appear to be stressed. And corn feed demand was projected to be down before the January cattle on feed report, 5% relative to a year ago. So we have a situation where the supply side is somewhat questionable in terms of whether we can really do 164 bushels an acre, but we think ethanol demand will go down this year for corn. We think feed demand might be down relative to a year ago. And to the extent that wheat prices are tied to corn prices, we'd want to be careful about assuming wheat has a lot of upside potential left in it given the current feed demand for the corn market. Here's July wheat futures prices from May 2005 through a couple of weeks ago. And what it looks to me like is over the last 2 years, we've really settled into a trading range of about $6 to $8. So we have a couple times we've been above $8, maybe once in that trading range below $8 from 2010 forward, but really a $6 to $8 trading range. From that perspective, the $7.20 forecast for cash prices is pretty much in the middle of this range, assuming a basis of just 10 or 15 cents, which is about where soft red winter wheat basis seems to be trading now in the Midwest. Here's July wheat futures prices. So this is the harvest contract for all of our winter wheats. And again, we sort of see that $6 to $8 trading range with a couple of extremes on each side of it. $7.20 maybe fits in there. But what's really important to remember, as we look at this trading range from 2010 through 2011, this is the period we've been tracking corn prices almost penny for penny, or at least dime for dime. These are cash prices of white wheat in Ritzville, Washington, over the last several years. Again, we see that the price level has become much significantly higher than it was before, $6 to $8 as opposed to $3 to $4. Also, a lot more price volatility. This is an important diagram, though, because as I've talked to wheat farmers in Washington, one of the things that they remember is $12 wheat or even $10 wheat, and there's a lot of reluctance to accept $8 wheat because we might go back to $10 or $12. That was really an anomaly, and when we start thinking about marketing strategies, it becomes important in my mind to sort of throw out some of these extremes. While they're possibilities, they tend to not have very high probabilities associated with them. They're not highly probable. And the other thing is they don't last very long. When we run up fast, we run down fast as well. So the overall story is that while prices could go back to the levels we saw in 2008, it's probably a relatively risky bet to sit on the sidelines waiting for that to happen. Here's a more condensed version, a shorter timeline. This is just from the summer of 2008, took out that big extreme, and now we see that $6 to $8 is a pretty good price, and in fact, there's times where we've been well below that over the last 2 or 3 marketing years. So what does that kind of mean? Well, right now, USDA farm-level prices for wheat are projected to be quite strong, and I would argue that they're very strong given the balance sheet bottom line, which is the stocks-to-use ratio and the overall carryout. World ending stocks are going to increase relative to last year, it looks like, be a record level, actually. It appears to me that over the last 2 or 3 months, speculative trading has cooled off a little bit, but this may be a short-run phenomenon. Why does that matter? If you really believe it was speculators that took us to those $10 and $12 prices earlier, if they're not there, then it has to be something more extreme than just their trading activity to get us there again. I think corn prices face some downside risk as ethanol feed demand and exports all weaken as we go into next year. Now, this assumes that the supply side of the balance sheet, as Ed pointed out, matches USDA's expectations, and maybe it doesn't. In my mind, when I look at the cash markets for both corn and wheat, I see two things. In the wheat market, basis is very strong, it appears, nationwide. And I think what that suggests is that the cash market believes that maybe USDA has underestimated the demand for wheat, and that's what's being traded in the futures market. In other words, futures traders are focused on the USDA balance sheet. Cash traders seem to be thinking maybe the demand side of that sheet is overly pessimistic and we can have some demand strengthening. If they're right, then we can certainly see some improvement in price as that plays itself out. On the corn side, I think there's a lot of people out there that believe, even for this marketing year, which we're halfway through, that stocks have been overstated. And we'll get another stocks report on March 29th, the quarterly stocks report. If, in fact, that ends up being true, then corn has some upside as well, and it can take wheat with it. What I would want to caution, though, is betting on either one of those events, sort of a confirmation that USDA has their numbers wrong, in the face of some of these other things we do know. It looks like world stocks for wheat will be up. U.S. stocks for wheat will be up. We are projecting a very high price for the given stocks-to-use ratio. And in my mind, that just suggests some caution in terms of thinking about marketing strategies going forward. Let me stop there, and we'll see if there's any questions we need to handle.
Thank you, Randy. A good presentation. I enjoyed that. I had a hard time keeping up writing all the notes. Questions, though, that come in. One of the questions I have is you talked about a volatility and possible activities that created that volatility quite a bit. Could you give us a measure of how do we measure the volatility in the market in terms of, say, dollars per bushel? Would you risk a measurement of that volatility?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me. Are you asking me to predict the price change over some period of time going forward? Is that what you mean, or
what? Well, yeah. What in terms of the volatility we have with respect to speculators? What size of the volatility have they introduced into the market?
I actually believe that their influence in the wheat market has been grossly overstated. And in fact, that's kind of what the one chart shows, where as you look at total wheat open interest increasing significantly, the speculators' positions over the last 3 years really haven't. So they have reflected a smaller and smaller market share of total futures trading in the wheat market over the last 2 or 3 years as total open interest has grown. That's not true in other markets, and that's why I sort of said these policies that sort of assume a one-size-fits-all in terms of managing either position limits or other ways to try to manage speculative activity are not going to have the desired effects in some markets that they might have in other markets. And wheat's one where I don't think, now I haven't done any empirical work on this, but I actually don't believe that the volatility can be explained by speculative money moving in and out of the market. That doesn't mean on a given day or a given couple of days, if a lot of money moves in or out, we don't see the price moving at the same time. But as I look at volatility longer term, wild price swings over 2, 3, 4 month periods, it's hard for me to assign that to speculative activity in this particular market.
Okay. One more quick question. And it's a little bit of a follow-on to that one. Do you think the speculators are in the wheat market more domestic or foreign, and is there a differential impact in those speculators?
That's a good question. So this is blind speculation on my part because I don't know. I haven't looked. My guess is in the wheat market they tend to be more domestic. Does it matter? I don't think it matters in terms of the price action. What matters is how much money's moving at any given moment in time. So I don't think it matters whether they are offshore or not offshore. I'm guessing, though, in the wheat market, most of the speculative activity, and we're just looking at the Chicago market here, but I think most of that speculative activity is coming from domestic speculative traders.
Okay, thank you. Let's go ahead and move on to our next presentation for this particular topic. Dr. Shannon Nybergs is an extension economist in the School of Economic Sciences at Washington State University and has recently taken over the directorship of the Western Center for Risk Management Education. And Shannon's primary extension effort is applied economics and related, which are related to livestock enterprises and risk management. As part of looking at the economics of livestock production system, Shannon has completed also hay and forage outlooks and tracks at hay and forage with respect to the livestock industry, as well as that industry itself. Shannon has been involved with projects examining the economics of infectious animal diseases and projects evaluating dairy nutrition, waste management, and economics of anaerobic digestion. As the director of the Washington State University Extension Western Center for Risk Management Education, he provides leadership for the extension risk management efforts in the 13 Western states and the U.S. and Pacific Islands. Shannon, it looks like we are all set up and ready to go for you, so go ahead and take it away.
Great, Duane. Thank you very much. It's exciting for me to be able to present this topic because I think this hay and forage market is very interesting and very dynamic, and given its importance to animal agriculture, I think it's a little bit underrepresented in the agriculture economics research field. So I'm going to present today some of the issues and current conditions in the hay and forage market. And to do my presentation, I'd like to take a supply and demand framework. And using that supply and demand framework, you can look at this price trend. This is the price trend going from 2005 to current. It's the monthly average price, U.S. alfalfa average price. And you can see a dramatic increase in price changes and price volatility. This next graph matches both the price to a measure of historic price volatility that's used typically in the futures market transactions, the standard deviation over 12 months. In this case, it's 12 months is my trading period to measure that volatility. And if you look at this red line graph, you can see that the volatility through 2006, and if you went back farther, you'd see relatively low volatility. But starting in 2007, to what is current, you see dramatic increases in that price volatility, and both changes up from 2006 to 2008, price decreases from 2008 to 2010, and then last year a dramatic price increase in volatility over the past year. So we want to take this time and evaluate some of those factors that evaluated that price trend. One other point I wanted to make before we get into some other slides is that the importance of regional influences on the hay market. And in this graph, I overlaid the Washington monthly price against the U.S. average price. And you see it really points to that the hay market has regional influences. And while the hay price went down across the United States around the 2010 area, if you look at that graph, in Washington, that price didn't see that much of a decrease. And that was due to some regional demand factors that Washington has relative to the United States. So as we go through the hay market part, we'll look at some regional differences and talk a little bit about the transportation, which is really part of the reason for these regional differences, is the transportation cost of hay limits large-scale distribution or large-distance distribution. So if we look at these primary supply factors, this is kind of the outline that I'll address on the supply side, is we're going to look at some alfalfa acres, all hay production in acres, the stocks, talk a little bit about corn silage, weather relative to drought, and the availability of irrigation water through the season, and then some pasture and range outlook on the supply side. So if we look at this map, and it points to the regional basis of production, the dark green states are areas of high alfalfa acres, high alfalfa production. We see that California, Idaho, Montana, and the northern tier states are the primary acres of alfalfa that are grown in the United States, and less through the southern tier of the country. And if we look at the decline in acres from 2010 to 2011 on this regional basis, the percents are relative to the actual numbers, but it points to some regional differences and regional declines. And if you look at Washington State had a decline of 16% in their alfalfa acreage over that past year, and California was 5%, and you see these lighter green states through the west, Nevada, a decrease of 11%, and on through the nation. And what that points to is the overall trend in this alfalfa acreage of declining. And if we look from 1990, this graph goes from 1990 to last year, 2011. Over that time period, the alfalfa acres have decreased by about 6 million acres from 1990 to 2011, and that's approximately a 25% decline in the alfalfa acres over that time. And we see that that decline, I highlighted the period of high volatility from that previous graph from 2008 to 2011, and we see that period of high volatility is associated with the declining production levels across the country. So we have the declining acres, declining supply, and then this increased volatility, and we'll address that through the presentation as well. If we look at all hay production, when we talk about forages, we need to talk about both alfalfa and all hay. All hay is grass hay and timothy and other soybean hays and all other hay varieties combined together. And I put a trend line on this graph. The trend line is trending downwards across that same 1990 to 2011 period, showing that the hay production is declining over time across the country. And then note the dramatic decrease in all hay production from 2010 to 2011. And we can look at some drought maps later in the presentation that kind of points as to why that large decline occurred over this past year. But again, declining supply, increased volatility over that time period. Now, if we look at stocks, just like we had carry-out stocks in wheat and corn that was discussed previously, where there's some carry-out stocks or end-of-year, beginning-of-next-year stocks, these are December 1 stocks. And if you put your attention to the 2011 year on the right, our carryout stocks of hay are very low relative to previous periods. And even hay growers meeting in Washington a couple weeks ago, and we talked about what their stocks were and where they were on their stocks, and Washington producers, their comments was that they were completely sold out of any alfalfa stocks. And their existing stocks that they were clearing out were the grass hay stocks in the bottom of the pile, low quality stocks, potentially rain damaged, moisture damaged hay, and that they're moving those stocks out now. And there's another point observation of indicating of those tight carry out stocks leading into the start of next year. So we won't get any price relief on the purchasing side of hay of high stocks, whereas they're, as this graph shows, they're very low. So one of the things that that's important to consider as well is that the move from hay to silage production. As you look at, as you talk to dairies, you look at feedlots and that what they are feeding is a roughage source, oftentimes you talk to them and they're talking about putting up more silage. They're trying to combat their risk on hay, and they're trying to look at other lower cost forages, and so they're looking at corn silage or other types of silage, whatever kind of silage that they can put up in their area, other hay silage, etc. And this graph shows the corn silage production in million tons from 2000 to 2011, and it shows that there's not been a dramatic increase in that corn silage production over the recent history. So we're not getting a lot of dramatic macro-level production changes of the substitution away from the declining alfalfa and hay acres into corn silage, but that's an area that's of interest to dairy producers and animal agriculture in itself, is that how are we going to provide roughage in the diet, and are we going to be substituting towards corn silage? And this graph shows that there's not been a dramatic increase over the past year. So now let's turn a little bit to looking at some drought conditions. And I put this slide in to provide a complete definition of what that drought is. Certainly I'm not a climatologist, but the drought, as we've heard and we'll see, has been very dramatic, and it's very important, and it's very important to the supply condition of hay and forages and pasture. And I'll point your attention to this middle paragraph, that the long-term drought is cumulative and that the intensity of the drought is dependent on current patterns and past weather patterns. And so we need to keep that in mind as we look at these drought maps. And that last paragraph is that the weather patterns can change, as they say in the definition, literally overnight. So you have to look at these drought conditions and pay close attention to current conditions and what those impacts have. But now let's look at just a few maps of drought severity and drought expectations into the future. And so this looks at this is August 2011 drought map. It shows in these purplish colored southern tier states, not only in the southwest of Texas and New Mexico that's gotten a lot of publicity for their drought, but also on the southern tiers around Florida and Georgia that also have severe drought at the end of last year, August 2011. So that's one point in time to consider. This map is one of the most current maps that you can find. It's February 28, 2012, and it shows that across the South there are still areas with extreme drought, but some moderation with some moisture that occurred through the winter months, but still showing moderate to severe drought, and also through moderate to severe drought through Texas and the those Texas, Oklahoma, into Colorado, into those states, but also currently into other southwestern states, looking at California, looking at Nevada, looking at the northern tier states, if you remember where alfalfa is being produced in the Corn Belt, looking at North Dakota and into Minnesota, is having some dryness and drought currently. And even into Washington through the Columbia Basin region, if you're familiar with Washington and that central part of the state, even a few, those were the comments across people who I've talked to in the Columbia Basin, is that they were dry through the winter. Building on that comment that drought conditions can change overnight, this week we've had a series of rain events and moisture events through Washington and the Pacific Northwest, and so it shows that it's a very dynamic the drought's very dynamic and current weather patterns can have great impact on that. And lastly, if we look at a drought outlook, this is a map of drought outlook. It was released March 1st, 2012. It's for the spring drought outlook condition stretching from March to May. And it shows some areas of concern. Certainly if you're in this area, it points to preliminary indications, potential indications of continued persistent drought to potentially intensify, or maybe some improvements. It was, you look at the green slashed areas in Colorado and western Texas and through northern California and into the Columbia Basin area of central Washington and north central Oregon. But this does point to some potential concerns, particularly with hay forage and pasture in these areas, as you look at the supply of those forage types in those areas. And so pasture conditions, and this is some of the most current information that I could find on pasture conditions. And so let's look at this for a minute on beef cows. On the left, beef cows in states with 40% poor to very poor pasture conditions. If we compare 2010 to 2011, you see a dramatic increase in the percent of beef cows that were in poor to very poor pasture conditions at the end of last year. Almost half of the beef cow population at the end of last year were in poor pasture conditions. And then on the right hand side, the cows with in states with 40% good to excellent condition, you see some decrease in the percent of total as you can compare 2010 to 2011. So the pasture conditions are also of a concern. They were a concern going out of this last year, and if you refer back to this area of drought persistence, if they were poor out of last year and it's expected to be poor next year, that leads to some very serious concerns on hay and forage conditions for those producers in that area. Okay, let's lastly look at snowpack measurements. Snowpack measurements are important for irrigation, reservoir supplies, and impacts on, certainly as we look in Washington on the Columbia Basin, on those irrigated alfalfa acres. And in the green is a relatively good snowpack. As I mentioned, that we're having a weather event this week. Some of these mountain areas are getting 2 feet of snow in addition just over this past couple days. And so the snowpack on the northern tier is looking good to better. But in comparison to the Sierra Nevadas in California, those snowpack levels are red. And so those red snowpacks are low snowpacks. And as of the map date of March 1st, those were low snowpack areas. And if you look at the trade information from California, they're having some water allocation declines. And what impact that have, that should be considered. I'm not an expert on what how severe those water allocation declines are for those California producers, but certainly California is an important alfalfa producing state and an alfalfa demanding state, so those low snowpack levels are not only important for hay, forage, and pasture conditions, but all of agriculture through California. Okay, so just quickly to review the supply outlook, we have hay acreage trending downward. We have the issue of Roundup Ready alfalfa undergone a period of legal challenges and court challenges and rulings, but the current decision is that there was a U.S. District Court in California decision affirming USDA reauthorization and resumption of sale and planting of Roundup Ready alfalfa effective just recently, February 2nd, 2012. What impact that has on production was that is, will that help producers view alfalfa acreage as a better crop alternative because it is a biotechnology plant? We'll have to see, but that's certainly an issue not only on the production side, but for the on the export market side. Roundup Ready alfalfa is an issue of concern, and we can talk about that a little bit more when we get to the export demand tables. That third bullet on the expected drought persistent across large areas is going to be very important. And even that, the note below that is the unknown pasture response on those pastures that have got rain that were in drought. What is that forage response? How bad, how much harm were those forage plants, how much harm did those forage plants incur relative to that drought, and will they recover once they get rain, and how will they recover is unknown. So that's another issue on that, the drought continuing its effects into 2012. There's ongoing tight supply conditions with severely constrained conditions in some regions. Okay, so now let's turn our attention to the hay and forage demand. Make a few points on this. So the hay and forage demands drive demand of the livestock production sector. So depending on the profitability of those livestock sectors is going to, in turn, relay impacts on their ability to pay and their overall demand for those forages. And the second point is that forages is that, as you see in that nutrition pyramid, is that the forages and are the building blocks of the ration. And so as nutritionists dealing with dairies, nutritionists dealing with feedlots, and even horse and hobby farms, they have to supply forages as part of the diet to their animals. And what that means is that there's a very inelastic demand for a minimum level of forages, and so that in turn leads to that high price volatility as supply gets constrained, the demand and need to provide this basic input on the ration is increased. So let's look at a few of the livestock sectors, and I won't go into great detail of this because we're going to have these presentations in the next section of this webinar conference, and so we'll have detailed discussions on beef and dairy. So I'm just going to highlight just a few points to make the forage presentation complete. And Randy mentioned in his presentation the limited margin of dairy, and this graph shows that in two different ways. It shows the federal milk order price. We see some recent decline in that milk order price, and so there's not a lot of price increase or price growth, unlike the beef that are seeing record prices, the lambs that are seeing record prices. The milk price is relatively low. It's not providing a lot of profitability support to the dairy sector. And in this lower graph on the right-hand side, the milk feed price ratio, that's a common graph produced by ERS through the USDA, looking at the profitability of the dairy sector. There has been some discussion that the ratio is might not be showing as profitable as using direct prices because of the price changes of milk and other factors. But it does point to a relative historic trend in profitability. And if you look at the milk feed price ratio of being 3 or greater for them to be profitable, the whole period, all the graphs are below 3. And importantly, for the start of 2012, that milk price ratio is very tight. The inventory numbers are relatively stable. There's about a little over 92 million head of dairy cattle that have to be fed. So that's looking at a demand factor, a mouse to feed, so to speak, that's relatively stable. On the beef side, that's different. On the beef side, the 2012 cattle inventories are as low as they were in the 1950s. A very dramatic decrease in cattle inventories, partly due to the drought, but also partly due to liquidation of due to high prices and price responses and profit taking on the cow-calf sector on not expanding herds and culling, and strong culling because of high culling prices. So those cattle inventories are low. They do have ability to pay. There's record high prices for calves, culls, and market weight animals. But the beef cattle production in the drought areas, drought-stricken areas, face significant challenge because not only do they have to pay high prices for wintering hay costs, but because of there's no forage availability, they have to pay high hay prices to keep their cattle alive, so to speak, throughout the year. Whereas typical, they're on low-cost forages, and so those are significant challenges facing those areas. So let's make a few comments. I want to make a few comments, and then we'll follow up. We'll make a few comments on the export hay demand because that's a very dynamic and interesting market. And so the western states are the primary exporters of hay. Japan is by far the largest market destination, followed by South Korea and Taiwan. The United Arab Emirates and China are increasingly important markets. They provide some variability in demand, export demand, that impacts the market on the demand side. They're in and out. Compressed hay is the primary form exported. There are some cubes and pellets, but compressed hay is by far the largest share of what's exported. And that last point, the exchange rates are extremely important. The hay prices are high, but our exchange rates are low. That is very important on influencing their demand. And also the backhaul shipping containers. As firms look to backhaul containers to the Asian market, Japan, China, etc., those empty backhaul containers are really important on making that transportation cost low enough to make that market feasible and feasible from the West Coast. Interesting on some comments on the price discovery on export hay. So the contracts between the hay exporters and hay producers are being negotiated now and have been negotiated over the past few weeks. They're negotiated in the spring of the production year as those exporters make their price predictions, have established some contract delivery points, and they go back and make those contracts. It's an early price discovery for hay that sets a price point in the market. It's very important for Washington and California, too, as those price points are set in the market before production. And the hay quality is absolutely critical. Hay quality is very important on delivering against those contracts. And hay quality points to restrictions on Roundup Ready alfalfa that Asian markets do not want genetically modified crops. They do not want Roundup Ready alfalfa, and so it's a big production issue across the region is contamination of seed and spread of Roundup Ready alfalfa into the fields and tests for delivering the hay that is certified Roundup Ready free is going to become increasingly important into the future. This is a table that I keep track of. It's a very interesting table looking at the market share between California ports and Pacific Northwest ports. And the contracts, the importers, the Asian importers are very put the exporters in California and the Northwest in a competitive framework as to where they're going to source their hay, whether it be California or these Pacific Northwest points. And this table provides the Department of Commerce export data in looking at what that market share is between these two regions. And it goes from 2007 to 2011. And it's the volume in the top segment of that graph. It's the percent change in volume exported from year to year through those numbers, and the market share as it moves back and forth between California and the Pacific Northwest. And you can see on the market share in 2007 and 2008, the Northwest had a higher market share, and we've lost some of that market share over the years to increasing exports originating out of California ports. And then jumping back to the top graph, you see that there is a slow and continued increase in the volume exported out of the West Coast states. So that's an interesting graph to maybe come back and look at if we had more time. So let's review the outlook in just the last few slides to finish this up. So the dairy herd is relatively stable, but dairy profitability continues to be challenging. The impacts of that is that there's substitution for hay for other lower cost roughages in the ration. If you talk to dairymen, they are always looking to, because of their profitability concerns, they would like to feed more hay, but because of the high cost, they are substituting away for it as much as they can find substitutes that will work in their ration. One of the issues is also a month-to-month contract. Typically, historically, if you thought about managing your dairy, you wanted to contract and secure your hay supply over the year. But because of the high cost, because of cash flow concerns, there's been an increase on month-to-month contracts for the purchase of dairy needs, and that's increasing their risk as that goes through. Beef herd inventories at historic lows, but cattle prices are at record high. Provides them some ability to pay, as I said before, but the drought-stricken areas face significant challenges to 2012 on pasture and range conditions and wintering costs of needing to purchase hay. Horses and hobby ruminants have an inelastic demand for small-sized baled hay. That's becoming an increasingly important issue because most of the alfalfa producers do not want to produce hay using small-sized bales. And so those supplies is declining, but given their inelastic demand, those prices are increasing, and that might turn out to be a niche market for some alfalfa producers or hay producers as well. The export market is expected to be stable to increasing because they also have an inelastic demand, the favorable exchange rates that are expected to continue, but as part of that export market, the early price discovery contracts that we talked about, but those contracts are confidential, so it's hard to find out what those prices are being contracted on to get indications moving forward through the season. Transportation costs are going to become an increasingly important determining point of sale price. As you look at if they have to transport hay from northern tier states down to drought-stricken areas in the south, they were paying reports of well over $300 a ton for hay delivered to those southern tier states that were impacted by drought. But as everybody knows, and the news is on these increasing fuel costs and maybe potentially record high fuel costs, the feasibility of transporting that hay north to south is going to be challenged. And the ability of people to pay is going to be challenged if indeed those droughts, that drought-stricken areas continue. And so that was that last point. Lastly, in conclusion, drought, tight supply, and inelastic demand resulted in record high prices in 2011. Early seasonal drought indicates expanding drought areas. And it's a bullish outlook for 2000 hay and forage prices, and that's why I left. I re-put this U.S. alfalfa price showing where we left off in 2011 and potentially where we'll be in 2012. And lastly, there's limited opportunity to hedge hay and forage price risk, and we could expand on that if there's any questions, but I want to get done, so I'll stop there.
Thank you, Shannon. Give us a lot to think about in the hay markets. The presentation talked about tight supplies to a fairly large extent. Are there regional implications for the tight supplies in the Northwest and going into the future here? The drought has been in the South Central, but can you touch a little bit more on regional implications for tight supplies and how we might satisfy that in a regional fashion? Or is there just nothing available?
I think the best answer to that, Duane, is that there is nothing available. Even the tight supplies in the Northwest, we have great hay growing conditions, but we have decreasing acreage because people are not expanding alfalfa, reestablishing alfalfa fields. We talked about that at the producers meeting as they went around the room and go, have you seen any expansion in hay acres being expanded? And there was very limited reestablishment, and most people were taking crops out because it was this hard, risky crop to grow. There's a lot of field operations that you have to take through the cuttings, and a lot of risk that has to be incurred. Not only on the risk is in rain on first cutting hay. If you look at the past several years, is that in California and in Washington and in Idaho, when the producers were ready to produce first cutting alfalfa, is that there were rain events that caused widespread damage to the hay, and so that risk is high. And so there's not an expansion of hay acres, and that's leading to continued tight supplies. And so I think that's pretty well across the country, certainly across the West.
Okay. Move on to the panel discussion. If I could have Randy and Ed chime back in if they're available here.
I'm here.
Okay, we'll have some panel discussion. My first point is across sort of all of the speakers here. You've talked about tight supplies in the hay market, the corn production and soybean production being limited for corn acres and things like that, and the wheat. Randy talked about having some good carryover stocks and availability. With respect to additional resources coming out, CRP, for example, coming out and going back into production, I'd like to get each of your thoughts on how that will help, if any, in terms of the tight supplies for corn and soybeans and hay. And I'll start with Shannon and Randy. They're both in the same area there in terms of what are your thoughts on additional acres going into production for hay, Shannon?
Well, it's those CRP fields, we've done some work on CRP and conversion of CRP to cattle grazing operations. It's very interesting. A lot of that CRP acreage in Washington is in the summer fallow wheat area. Very, very large. It's across the wheat production area, but even more concentrated in the wheat summer fallow area, which is very dry. I would say that it's not so much a resource for hay production, but it has greater potential as a forage resource from April to June. And I'll stop there to let somebody else say.
Okay, Randy.
Well, as Shannon said, it is sort of in the wheat producing area. At current wheat prices, I think there's a lot of interest among wheat producers that also have CRP to think about bringing some of that back into wheat production. So I think, you know, if you think out 2 or 3 years, what happens to it, forage versus wheat, it's very much going to be driven by wheat prices. Right now, I think it would favor a return to wheat production. If you think about it nationally, it's kind of interesting because a couple years ago, there was a lot of talk, about increasing potential corn acres, for example, on CRP, to satisfy ethanol demand. But if you look at where those CRP acres that are coming out, a large percentage of them are in areas that really aren't conducive to corn production. So
A lot of it has to do with where the CRP acres are. And in Washington, as Shannon said, I think they will favor, at current prices, a return to wheat production.
Okay. Good. Your thoughts on CRP acreage in your region or in the Midwest corn soybean belt and how that might impact?
Well, this is Ed Usset. And, you know, most CRP acres, I think of them as being boy, this is going to sound harsh, marginal acres, if you will. This is not the heart of the Corn Belt. I see it, if anything, more small grains. And, you know, it's not a corn and soybean issue in my mind.
Okay. In the, back to Shannon for the hay there, what are the impacts of the cumulative effect of maybe an increasing livestock herd as we try to expand the increasing demand that you suggested for the small horn of the horse operated, those kinds of activities on the hay market in the next year? Will that, will the cumulative demand for the potential increase in those demand be offset by any kind of supply side or just put upward pressure on prices?
I've been thinking about that, and I was in my opinion is where is that cow herd going to expand on the beef cow side? And I think that I was talking to some cattle producers and trying to, I don't know if convincing is the right word, but at least discuss with them that they have a relatively low drought risk. They have potential for low cost pasture and range that they can expand their herd on. And so regionally, I think on the beef cow side, there's going to be some regional advantages to expansion. And I think in the Northwest, we haven't had a drought lately in several years, and the drought hasn't been severe as what is seen in the Southwest. So I think it's regional. I think it's going to increase the demand for those hay wintering costs.
Okay. Ed, yes. One of the questions that have come in is, U.S. yield projections for corn and soybean is higher for 2012-13, yet there are current projections for drought. How do they get those estimates and reconcile those?
Well, those are what we call trend line estimates, the trend line yield. And if you get a room full of grain analysts together, nothing could start a fist fight quicker than a discussion of trend line yields and where they come from. It is, you know, in a nutshell, there are different ways of looking at it, but you look at the history and the increase in yields over time, and you try to project out how fast they're going, how fast they're rising, and they are, the trend line is certainly up in per acre production. It's just the USDA tends to use a trend line model that is pretty optimistic. If you want a more sober look at it, you look at what the University of Illinois does. They're about 7 bushels an acre apart on the year ahead. And it's not something I like to argue a lot about because time will tell which one comes true.
Okay. And Randy, a follow-up question on the wheat industry here. We got Ed's sense of some of the impact on corn and wheat prices, or corn and soybean prices on land values. Do you see similar implications for land values continuing for the wheat sector of the U.S.? Or are they likely to decline, or how much would they decline if prices decline?
Well, as Ed pointed out, it's really not just about the price, it's about the margin. What's the profitability per acre of production look like? My sense right now is, as I look forward a couple of years anyway, that I don't really see a decline, but I see maybe a flattening. Usually what we notice first is rental rates go up, and then land prices tend to follow that. But if prices stay sort of in the $6 to $8 range as an average price, then I suspect that what we're going to sort of see is a flattening of prices, but certainly not a decline.
Thank you. Well, given that we have lots of other questions to ask here, but given interest in time and getting on to our next session, I'd like to thank our speakers. The remaining sessions for the day are livestock and dairy, which will be coming up at the top of the hour, and then followed by the specialty niche and food safety session at the end of the day. Again, we'd like to point you to the Ag and Uncertain Times companion website. We'll have the recordings of the webinars today. The presenter slides will be available at that set, contact information, and discussion of the webinar topics that we've had in the, today and in the past. We'd like to give you this opportunity also to go to the chat pod on the left-hand side of the screen and provide us some with input and feedback on what you like to see today and additional items that you would like to see covered in an Ag and Uncertain Times webinar. Send an email to the westrme@wsu.edu with your comments. We'd appreciate that very much. At the end of the session, we always give you an opportunity to download a pod that has the links for the information we had today. Put that pod on the screen now, and that'll allow you to click on the file listed in that pod, and then you can save to your computer the links for today, and it will lead you to the website and the resources that we discussed. I'd like to take the final opportunity to thank all of our speakers, Ed, Randy, and Shannon, for excellent presentations. And also, on behalf of our AIU team working in the background, we thank you for joining us and hope you will join us again at the top of the hour for the next session. Thank you.